Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, at least for a few more months, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening to this lecture to mark the centenary of the BSc in economics. The LSE, as I think everyone here knows, was founded in 1895, so you might wonder why we're having a centenary tonight. Perhaps it is not as well known that when the LSE was founded, it was not part of a university, did not give degrees, and in fact did not even examine its students. Some might like that regime to continue. It simply put on lecture courses which it hoped might assist students with, for example, their civil service exams. A few years after the LSE was founded, however, the University of London was reconstituted in more or less its present form, and at that time the LSE became a college of the university and was able to teach University of London degrees. LSE set up the first social science degree in London at that point, and indeed the country. This was the BSc Econ, which enrolled its first students 100 years ago in the academic year 1902 to 1903. After the lecture this evening, you're invited to an exhibition and reception, which will be held in the new Student Services Centre, which is just around to the left as you get out of the lecture hall here. And I'm required to ask you to hold on to your tickets, as you may need them for entry to the reception. Tonight's lecture is being given by Professor Charles Bean, Professor of Economics at the LSE and Chief Economist at the Bank of England. Professor Bean has a doctorate from MIT and worked at the Treasury before joining the Economics Department here in 1982. He became Professor of Economics in 1990. He taught for many years on the BSc Econ degree and was responsible for the last major reform of its structure in the mid-1990s. He has been Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Bank since October 2000. He is a member of the Monetary Policy Committee and responsible for monetary analysis and statistics at the Bank. Professor Bean has published widely on many fields of applied macroeconomics, in particular unemployment, monetary policy, and European Monetary Union. He has been an advisor to the Treasury, special advisor to committees of both Houses of Parliament, and to the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee of the European Parliament. He is therefore ideally qualified to speak on his topic this morning, this evening, which you see announced up here. It shows I'm not living in the real world, but he is. And his topic is economists and the real world. Please give him a very hearty round of applause on his return to the LSE.
Good evening. I have to say it's a really great pleasure to be back here. It wasn't so much of a pleasure standing here when I used to lecture from this stage. But it's very nice to be back and to see so many familiar faces in the audience. When I used to teach courses with other members of the department, I usually used to make an effort to coordinate my interventions and material with the other speaker. It never occurred to me that coming here tonight, I ought to coordinate my remarks with the remarks of the introducer. Since Tony has managed to steal the first page of my speech covering the history of the BSc. And not only that, he's stolen my joke about students today not wanting examinations.
I'll pass you a few more jokes as you go.
I do have one other nugget in there, though, that may interest you. Tony's already said that although the school was founded in 1895 and lectures actually started that year on the 10th of October, the degree didn't begin until 1902 after the school was incorporated in the University of London and the Faculty of Economics set up in the university and the degrees actually formally constituted. One nugget I did discover, though, was that in the first year of lectures, so this is back in 1895, before the degree was constituted, the fees were actually set at £3 a year. Now, that may not sound very much to the students, particularly the UK students in the audience, but measured relative to average earnings, that's equivalent to about £1,100 in today's money, which is a curiously familiar number. as Tony has already said, the first intake to the degree was in 1902. I might say a few words about what students had to take at that time, since it's quite revealing. The first intake of BSc Econ students were expected first to pass an intermediate examination, which some years later metamorphosed into something called Part 1, which some of you may remember. And that intermediate examination comprised four subjects: economics, which included economic principles and economic history, British Constitution, mathematics or statistics, and geography, and by that is meant economic and political geography rather than natural geography. Having successfully passed that intermediate examination, they would then go on to do courses in economics, history, public administration, finance, and an essay. And after that, a number of papers specialising in one of analytical and descriptive economics, economic history, political thought, public administration, banking and currency, international trade, transport, insurance, or statistics and demography. Now, that's actually a surprisingly modern-sounding list that's not a million miles away from the menu that confronts today's students, although I would hope that the content, at least, has moved on a little bit since then. And while subjects such as sociology, psychology, and international relations have been added, that general structure of a broad introductory year across a range of disciplines, followed by progressively greater specialisation in one or two particular fields, has remained. And though the BSc Econ was actually replaced in the early 90s, as Tony mentioned, about 92-93, and I was actively involved in that restructuring, the new degrees that came in economics, economic history, and the like, retained very much the essence of the old BSc Econ in their general structure. So there is a strong degree of continuity from the original degree structure to what is in the current degrees. Now, even at the outset, the BSc Econ was never just an economics degree. Indeed, economics in those days was a much broader, if less deep, discipline than today, embracing also politics and moral philosophy, as indicated by its older name of political economy. And over time, the BSc Econ embraced progressively more of the emerging fields of social science. But economics has always been very much at the centre of the degree, and it's on economics that I'm going to focus on in the remainder of this talk. Now, when Richard Jackman invited me to give this birthday address, he suggested that in addition to saying a few words about the history of the degree, I might also usefully reflect on the contribution of economics, and in particular LSE economists, to the wider world. Now, this is hardly the most narrow of remits. The subject matter of economics is probably of more immediate relevance to the man in the street than that of almost any other social science. Economists study which goods consumers choose to buy, how much labour they choose to supply. They study how much output businesses produce, by what means they produce it, and what price they charge for it. They study how those businesses interact in various market settings, and how they choose to organise themselves. They study how economies grow, what causes inflation and unemployment, and why there are periodic fluctuations in economic activity. And increasingly, economists are applying the basic insights of the theory of choice under scarcity to all sorts of problems that one might not think of as the natural domain of economics, such as marriage and even drug addiction. Now, I believe economics offers deep insights into these questions, and moreover, that those insights can usefully inform the design of policy and so improve the lot of mankind. But it has to be said that many non-economists, including many politicians, although I'll exempt the one or two who are in the audience tonight, take a somewhat jaundiced view of the potential contribution of economics. In part, that is because the conclusions of economic reasoning often seem to offend common sense. And in part, it reflects the supposed tendency of economists to disagree, which was neatly encapsulated in Winston Churchill's exasperated observation that if you put two economists in a room, you will get two different opinions. That is, unless one of them happens to be Lord Keynes, in which case you would invariably get three quite different opinions. But common sense is frequently a poor guide to the right answer in economics. While sometimes sufficient for assessing the immediate effect of some change in the economic environment, common sense is often not so helpful at tracing through all the consequential adjustments and interactions in a coherent fashion. As a consequence, many common sense nostrums about economics are often fallacious. Let me cite a few examples to illustrate the point. Consider first the impact of more immigration. Now, a common belief that you'll come across is that these additional workers will simply displace indigenous employees, raising unemployment. Now, this may indeed be the short-run effect, though as often as not, the migration will itself be a response to unfilled job vacancies in the country. But in any case, the reduction in labour market tightness will then tend to hold wages lower than they would otherwise have been. That in turn will boost the demand for labour and encourage extra investment. In the long run, output will be higher and under constant returns to scale by the same proportion as the increase in the labour force. As a second, although related example, consider the case of some technological advance that allows a firm or sector to produce the same output with less labour. From Ned Ludd onwards, common sense has had it that such technological progress will destroy jobs. Now, it may indeed lead to immediate job losses in the firm where the advance occurs, but then again it may not, as the lower cost of production also allows the firm to lower its prices and boost the demand for its product. Whether employment rises or falls will then depend on how much the demand for the product is affected by its price. And if overall employment does fall, then the processes described above in relation to immigration will kick in, ensuring the extra labour is brought back into use. Now, these are both examples of the lump of labour fallacy, that there is only so much work to go around, and it's just a question of how it's shared out. Economic analysis is, I think, useful in exposing the forces that ensure this is not, in fact, the case. But the arguments that I've given are theoretical arguments. Do they hold up in reality? This chart shows that the labour force has doubled since the middle of the 19th century, while productivity has risen sevenfold. If you believed either of the common sense nostrums that I talked about a moment ago, you would have expected this to have shown up as a trend in unemployment. But if you look at my second chart, you'll see that unemployment, although it has lots of wiggles and occasional steps up and down in general level, has no discernible trend in it to match the ongoing increase in the labour force and productivity. As another example where common sense can mislead, take the issue of international trade, so much to the fore at present with the debate over globalisation. My colleagues on the MPC and I spend quite a bit of our time going out meeting with groups of local businessmen through the bank's network of regional agents, who have something like 7,000 business contacts in the country, finding out about what life is like at the sharp end. I have to say it's a very salutary experience. But a common, if slightly caricatured, view we often hear is that international trade is essentially a zero-sum game and that Britain is losing out because of the shifting of production to China and other low-cost developing countries. Now, as with the earlier examples I gave you, there is a germ of truth in the businessman's conventional wisdom. At the level of the individual firm, trade is close to being a zero-sum game. If I'm a firm and my foreign competitor wins the orders, then I certainly lose out. But what is true at the level of the individual firm is not true at the level of the economy as a whole. As a nation, we gain by importing goods and services that are cheaper than we can make at home, exporting in return goods and services that are cheaper for us to make. So both our trading partners and we benefit from the extra trading opportunities that international trade brings. Now, at this point, the non-economist will usually argue that surely we cannot produce anything that's tradable more cheaply than the Chinese, given their very low labour costs. But if that were the case, all production of tradable goods and services would shift to China, precipitating counteracting movements in wages and prices, both there and here. The great, and to a non-economist, counterintuitive insight of trade theory is that it is comparative, not absolute, advantage that ends up governing the international pattern of production, and that trade is generally beneficial to both parties. Viewed from this perspective, the displacement of low-cost production to China, Eastern Europe, and other low-cost producers, together with the associated decline in the share of manufacturing in GDP that is observed in most developed countries, and you can see in this chart, should be recognized as, at least in part, reflecting the working out of this principle of comparative advantage. Moreover, that is also part of the process whereby living standards in the developing countries rise. All the evidence suggests that international trade is good for growth in living standards, something that many of the critics of globalization seem to be unaware of. Now, to be sure, there are many important distributional issues that are thrown up by these examples. If migration is concentrated amongst particular skill groups, or if technical progress affects the demand for a particular type of labor, then the distribution of wages will be affected. And in the trade example, the returns to those factors that are relatively scarce in a country will tend to fall in relative terms. At the current juncture, that means the wages of the relatively unskilled in the United Kingdom. Indeed, both skill-biased technical change and globalization are possible explanations for the widening in the distribution of earnings in the United States and the United Kingdom that has taken place over the last decade or so. Now, exposing the fallacy, or at least incompleteness, in the common sense view of these problems does not involve any great technical firepower. Indeed, I would expect anyone who had sat, and I guess they might need it also to have passed it, a second year economic principles course to be readily able to construct the arguments that I've just given. And there are many other examples one could give where even quite basic economic analysis points to a different conclusion from that given by common sense. Mostly, that is because common sense does not properly take account of the way economic agents adjust their behavior and how this leads to associated changes in prices and quantities through the market mechanism. It is tracing through these adjustments and seeing how the whole story plays out that economists tend to be better at. And it is because there are legitimate differences of view about the quantitative importance of the different effects and channels that two economists who may share the same analytical apparatus may nevertheless end up disagreeing about the final result. But overall, I believe economists have really far more in common than Winston Churchill's caricature suggests. Now, it is this ability to understand how agents might change their behavior in response to an alteration in their environment, and how those changes feed through the economy, that is most valuable when the economist becomes a policy advisor. The first inclination of many policymakers is often to attack the symptoms of a problem rather than its underlying causes. The response is frequently to impose controls through legislation, which as often as not may turn out to be counterproductive or else end up having unintended consequences. By asking what the underlying cause is, where the market failure is, and tracing through the full consequences of a policy intervention, economists can guide decision makers towards the implementation of policies that are both more effective at achieving their intended objective and in avoiding any associated unintended consequences. Now, the LSE has always set great store by the practical aspects of economics. The original 1895 prospectus stated that, I quote, "The special aim of the school will be, from the first, the study and investigation of the concrete facts of industrial life and the actual working of economic and political relations as they exist or have existed in the United Kingdom and in foreign countries." So a clear emphasis there on economics as a practical tool, both to understand and potentially to improve the world. And that is exemplified by the many faculty members, not to mention alumni, who have played a role at some time in the formulation of public policy, either here or overseas. Now, for some, it's been achieved by moving out of academia into politics. William Huyns, who was the first director and an economist with a somewhat of a bent towards history, became a Conservative MP after he ceased to be director and engaged very heavily with the campaign for tariff reform. But perhaps the most notable faculty member who moved across into politics was Hugh Dalton, a member of staff for nearly 20 years. He went on to achieve high office as Chancellor of the Exchequer in the post-war Labour government. There are, of course, some who have managed to combine a role in politics with continued activity in academia through elevation to the House of Lords, and there's two current members of the department in that category. But more frequently, I guess, LSE economists have impacted on policy through their advice. Perhaps the most notable of all in this category was Lionel Robbins. Also a former student, Robbins joined the staff in 1925, rising meteorically to a chair 4 years later. As well as being a key influence in the development of economics at LSE during the 1930s, his influence and involvement outside was substantial. In 1930, he was appointed to a committee of the Economic Advisory Council, chaired by Maynard Keynes, whose task was to identify the causes and remedies for the then-developing slump. Robbins and Keynes had very different views. Keynes at that time was groping towards the ideas that would be elaborated at length 6 years later in the general theory, while Robbins, with his more neo-Austrian approach, was instinctively less interventionist than Keynes was. They disagreed in particular over the question of trade protection, leading Robbins to submit a minority report and creating a certain amount of ill feeling. That disagreement with Keynes subsequently broadened out into a wider intellectual debate over the validity of the Keynesian vision and the relative merits of deflation and demand management as ways of fighting recessions. Now, while relations with Keynes were frosty during this period, they were later to work together in perfect harmony, first when Robbins joined the economic section of the War Cabinet, and then subsequently when he accompanied Keynes to the Bretton Woods Conference that drew up the blueprint for the post-war international financial order. Finally, mention should also be made of Robbins' later contribution to education policy in his role as chair of the Committee on Higher Education that paved the way for the great expansion of higher education that took place in the late 60s. Robbins is not the only policy giant of the 30s and 40s. One should also mention William Beveridge, who was director of the school from 1919 to 1937, whose wartime report, Full Employment in a Free Society, recommended the establishment of a national health service, national insurance and assistance, family allowances, and stressed the importance of full employment as a way of relieving want. That report laid the foundations for the post-war welfare state. As we move into the post-war period, so it has become more common for academic economists to cross the boundary into the provision of policy advice. Now, in a short lecture, I can't hope to do justice to the many LSE faculty who have contributed to the formulation of economic policy in some way or other. But even in my time at the LSE, I can think of members of the department who have been actively involved on such matters as the design of tax and social security systems, efficiency of delivery in public spending, the organisation and finance of higher education, urban and transport policy, the implementation of competition policy, policies to fight unemployment, reform of the international financial architecture, development policy, often through the auspices of the World Bank, and post-communist economic reform. The list is virtually endless, and I could add many more examples. Furthermore, the influence of LSE economists on public policy is by no means confined to those who have served as policymakers or advisers to policymakers. As Keynes once observed, practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Those toiling away developing the theoretical and analytical foundations often have a major impact through the way they influence the thinking of other, perhaps more practically oriented people. Nine economists connected with the department have been awarded the Nobel Prize, and their contributions have profoundly affected the way others approach problems. Now, given the range of policy questions to which LSE economists have contributed, rather than try to cover everything, I thought I would do better simply to make a few brief remarks relating to some of the contributors in my own field of macroeconomics and monetary economics. Now, I've already mentioned the LSE v. Cambridge debate about the validity of the Keynesian vision, Robbins versus Keynes, and of course Hayek also on Robbins's side. Now, that's an exchange in which it has to be said LSE came off on the losing end. In the years after the Second World War, the key objective for macroeconomics was refining the Keynesian vision. Now, much of this was conducted in the framework of John Hicks's ISLM apparatus, still taught in economic principles courses today, which is a distillation of the model contained in the general theory. Now, Hicks, of course, had previously been a member of the LSE staff, although when he wrote the particular paper in question, he had moved to Cambridge, the other place. But the ISLM model is an incomplete model, as it says nothing about the determination of prices. And it was that hole that a member of the LSE department, Bill Phillips, plugged with his discovery of an apparent inverse relationship between wage inflation and the level of unemployment. And here you have what was essentially the data that Phillips was using over the pre-First World War period and then the post-war period. I've also added in the 10 years' worth of data after Phillips wrote his original article. Some astute people might have noticed that I've left out the interwar period. That's because the relationship doesn't fit so well then. Phillips' original article has some discussion of those issues. Now, as you can see, there's what looks like a rather nice inverse relationship between wage inflation on the vertical axis and the unemployment rate on the horizontal axis. Now, while Phillips wasn't himself engaged in active policy advice to any great extent, this empirical relationship represented a seminal contribution to the conduct of macroeconomic policy. It's also represented the key battleground for controversies over macroeconomic policy since, and provides a convenient backdrop against which to describe some of the other LSE contributions in this field. Phillips's contribution appeared to imply a trade-off between the level of activity and inflation, although it should be said that Phillips's own interpretation was somewhat more subtle. But at least according to the simple interpretation of these scatter plots, governments could elect to have higher output and lower unemployment if they were prepared to accept somewhat higher inflation. At this point, to many macroeconomists, the broad structure of the macroeconomy had now been settled, and all that was left was to fill in the details. The decade following the publication in 1958 of Phillips' article marked the high point, although some might describe it as a nadir, of the application of Keynesian fine-tuning to steer the economy. But a fundamental challenge to this view of the world was brewing in the shape of Milton Friedman, who, as far as I know, has no connection with the LSE department. There's always got to be one. Friedman's 1968 exploration of the analytical foundations of Phillips's relationship cast doubt on the existence of such a long-run trade-off between activity and inflation, and indicated that output could rise above its natural rate only for as long as inflation was higher than agents expected. Attempts to exploit the apparent short-run trade-off to raise output above its natural rate would in due course merely lead to that trade-off shifting upwards as expectations adjusted. Moreover, the impact of macroeconomic policy on demand was uncertain in both magnitude and timing, making any attempt to eliminate fluctuations around the natural rate potentially counterproductive. According to this view of the world, the best policymakers could do was to eschew the fine-tuning of activity and simply keep the money supply growing at a low and steady rate, thus guaranteeing low inflation over the medium term. Now, while the key players in this monetarist counter-revolution were based at Chicago, as well as Milton Friedman, Robert Lucas is a key figure. Harry Johnson and Alan Walters at LSE both played a significant role in espousing these ideas on this side of the Atlantic. The latter achieved a notable success by correctly predicting that the rapid monetary expansion of 1972-3 under the Barber boom would be associated with a subsequent acceleration in inflation rather than higher activity, which is the vertical leg up here, where you can see inflation rises with essentially no associated fall in unemployment. Increasingly, politicians retreated from the Keynesian approach and recognized the importance of monetary control, the adoption of monetary targets by Dennis Healey in 1977 being a precursor to the wholesale embrace of monetarist thinking by the Thatcher government that entered power in 1979. Alan Walters, of course, subsequently became Mrs. Thatcher's personal economic guru, and in that role was highly influential, notably in arguing against sterling joining the European exchange rate mechanism. Now, the period after this, after 1980, was marked by continually rising unemployment, not only in the UK, as illustrated here, but also many other European economies. In part, this was the result of the pursuit of counter-inflationary macroeconomic policies. You can see inflation coming down, so this segment here looks like it could be part of a Phillips curve. But the persistence of high employment, once inflation had stabilized, was something of a puzzle that the monetarist model could not easily explain. Not only did the short-run trade-off shift up and down as inflation expectations rose and fell, as Friedman had suggested, but it also appeared to shift in and out. And now Richard Layard, Steve Nicol, and others at the LSE's Centre for Labour Economics were at the forefront of showing how this was related to the nature of labour market institutions and how temporary shocks could end up having persistent effects. That contribution has also proved influential in the debate over appropriate policies for the labour market and particularly in the design of Labour's New Deal. My final episode in the life of the UK Phillips curve, the green bit, concerns the period since Britain's exit from the exchange rate mechanism in 1992 and the subsequent adoption of inflation targeting. Recently arrived from LSE, Mervyn King, who was then the Bank of England's chief economist, the role I know hold, played a key role in persuading the Treasury of the virtues of adopting an inflation target to replace the exchange rate target that we had abandoned when we left the exchange rate mechanism. And of course, since the bank was handed operational responsibility for setting interest rates in 1997, LSE has been very strongly represented on the Monetary Policy Committee. No less than six of the 18 members who have sat on the committee have been members of the department at LSE at some time or another. Now, it's often said that central bank independence is desirable because it takes the politics out of monetary policy. But an equally important feature of the present UK arrangement is, I believe, the extent to which it has also put economics right at the centre of monetary policy. The MPC is a committee composed of economists and economically literate technocrats to a degree that is probably unique. And I believe that feature greatly facilitates our deliberations. When we meet each month to set the official interest rate, we're confronted with masses of economic and survey data, often giving conflicting signals, not to mention a mass of qualitative information from the business contacts of our agents. The chart pack, this is a file with lots of tables and charts in, that we take into the committee room each month, contains more than 1,000 individual data series and charts. Drawing all this information together so as to get a picture of where the economy is, let alone where it is headed, is by no means a straightforward task. Quantitative economic models help, but need to be accompanied by a lot of independent, critical economic analysis and a good dose of informed economic judgment. Now, there's certainly no guarantee that a committee of economically literate individuals will always get the policy judgment right. But in my view, they have a better chance than one composed of individuals with little or no facility in economic analysis. And that is particularly so at times of turbulence and great uncertainty, like the present, where there is a real premium in being able to separate the substance from the froth. Has the MPC delivered what it was supposed to? Well, as my chart shows, our target measure of inflation for the retail price index, excluding mortgage interest payments, has stayed quite close to, although mostly a little below, our mandated target of 2.5% in the period since independence. And let's just zoom into that little period. Now, in the context of past UK inflation performance, the slide I had up a moment ago, that's not at all bad. And moreover, this relatively good inflation performance has been associated with a growth performance that has, for the most part, been relatively good compared to that of the other G7 countries. Now, it would be unreasonable to expect inflation to be always exactly at 2.5%, as there are bound to be unanticipated shocks that we will be unable to offset, or else may choose to accommodate in order to avoid inducing undue volatility in output. But some observers have taken us to task for allowing inflation to persistently undershoot the target in the period since 1999. That undershoot, which averages about 0.5 percentage point, has certainly not been by design. Each quarter we publish conditional projections for inflation and growth as a probability distribution or fan chart in our inflation report. And our mean projection for inflation 2 years ahead has, over this period, always been very close to 2.5%. So that our average 2 year ahead forecast error has also been about 0.5 percentage point. If you like, you can think of this discrepancy here as reflecting our 2 year ahead inflation forecasting error. Now, this small, though persistent, undershoot is, I think, less significant than it appears. Inflation is a persistent process. Indeed, it's quite close to being a random walk on quarterly data. And it can take a year and a half or so for most of the effect of a change in interest rates to feed through to inflation. The consequence is that even if our forecasts were optimal and the forecast errors for quarterly inflation random, the prediction errors for annual inflation 2 years ahead should be highly persistent, as would therefore also be true of the outturns of inflation compared to the target. Now, a report on the bank's modelling and forecasting activities by Professor Adrian Pagan of the Australian National University will be published tomorrow, and it includes a simple statistical analysis of our past forecast errors. His analysis suggests about a 1 in 5 chance of observing a run of 8 consecutive quarters with forecast errors of the same sign, even if forecasts are formed optimally. And his analysis also implies that really a rather tiny bias of just 0.02 percentage points in our projection of the quarterly inflation rate would be enough to generate an average undershoot of the magnitude actually observed. Now, of course, this is not to say we should not try to learn from even relatively small errors. The forecasting error here can be traced to two factors: the unexpected strength of sterling in the first part of the period and a better than expected supply performance thereafter. And the committee has absorbed those lessons over time into its analysis. A more interesting feature, in my view, than the undershoot is the overall stability of inflation over this period, which was also reflected in the apparently very flat Phillips curve over the last decade, and the fact that since independence, the governor has not yet had to write an open letter to the chancellor, as would have been the case if inflation had strayed more than 1 percentage point from target in either direction. An unresolved question is whether this stability, which has coincided with remarkably stable growth, is mainly down to the change in the monetary regime and the associated anchoring of inflationary expectations, the result of structural changes to the economy, including a better functioning labour market, the effects of information technology and enhanced international competition, or just down to a fortuitous sequence of shots. That bears on the question of whether we can expect such relative stability to continue in the future or not. The present environment is a challenging one for us on the MPC. Against the background of a sharp global downturn, the UK economy has managed to keep growing at only a little below its trend rate. But that has been achieved only through boosting domestic demand, and especially consumer spending, to offset the external weakness. Consequently, beneath the surface, there have been significant and growing divergences between the performance of the tradable and non-tradable parts of the economy. So long as the global recovery remains patchy, it is important that domestic spending remains strong. But eventually spending will need to slow and the associated imbalances unwind. Achieving such a rebalancing smoothly would be quite an achievement for the committee, especially against the particular uncertainties posed by the current threat of war in Iraq and the recent fragility in financial markets. Beyond these immediate concerns, we and other central banks are grappling with a range of issues concerning the appropriate conduct of monetary policy in a world of low inflation, such as what role should asset prices and financial imbalances play in the conduct of monetary policy? Is deflation a potential problem, and what can policy do about it? And how will the return to a low inflation environment affect the behaviour of economic agents? Mervyn King, now the bank's governor designate, once said in a speech from this very spot that his objective was to make monetary policy boring. Now, I don't know whether we've succeeded in that yet, but one thing I can assure you of is that the making of monetary policy is certainly not boring. If there is one thing I'm sure about, it's that LSE economists will continue to contribute to the making of better monetary policies as much in the next century as they have in the last one. And I'm sure that will be equally true of the many other areas of policy making where economics has so much to offer. Thank you.
We've got about, I'm afraid, only about 10 minutes for questions. If anybody wants to ask, please ask away, because the reception is supposed to start fairly sharpish at 7. So one or two nice, succinct and probing questions would be
good. Not too probing.
Not too probing.
Please.
Can you wait for the microphone? There are roving mics on both levels of the lecture hall.
How is the view? Sorry. How has the FTSE's recent downturn affected your view of the UK economy?
You're going to have to wait until, I think it's February the 15th, the inflation report is published, and it will all be revealed then. We're currently in the middle of an inflation report forecasting round, where obviously this is one of the issues that we're looking at, and it needs to be looked at in conjunction with all of the other bits of information and news that have come in recent weeks and months. One thing I will say is clearly not good news.
See any other hands? Maybe you could wait for the mic as well so that people up the top can hear.
Charlie, if there's been no MPC, and no Treasury interest rate policy, and interest rates had simply been settled by demand and supply of securities, do you think that inflation chart would look very different today?
You have in mind a sort of free banking world. You have to have a story about how the amount of currency is going to be supplied in the world that you're talking about. I'm not an... Right. Okay. Well. There are some economists who argue that governments should not have a monopoly over the supply of base money, and that it should be left to the market, and people can create competitive monies. Now, I think there are issues there. I mean, money is, by its nature, it has public good elements to it. So I think there are problems about applying the competitive paradigm just like that. And without really specifying exactly what the world looks like in this alternative story where you haven't got a central bank controlling the interest rate or the supply of money, it's a bit difficult to know whether the outturns would have been any better or not. I mean, personally, I think performance has been pretty good over the last decade. So I'd take a lot of convincing that an alternative arrangement that did not have central banks setting interest rates or controlling the supply of money would produce a better outcome.
Question, another question down the front, maybe someone from... Oh, yeah, good.
Thank you. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk about the rise of China. To what extent has China's rise as an economic power been responsible for the low rate of inflation and fears of deflation that we can see around the world at the moment?
It's responsible for, or partly responsible, it's not entirely responsible, but it's partly responsible for the low rate of goods price deflation. I think a lot of recent commentary about deflation has been somewhat misguided in that it focuses on low rates of inflation or falling prices in a subset of the overall inflation index. And of course the counterpart to a very low rate of goods price inflation in the UK recently, for instance, is a very high rate of service price inflation, which is up around about 5%. And they average out to about 2.5%. And when you start talking about the possible pernicious effects of deflation, what one should be concentrating on there is what's happened to the general price level, not what's happening to relative prices. There's clearly been a real factor, the increase in international competition, and that potentially has beneficial effects, increasing the amount of global supply. But I think it is not something that should be tied into the question of deflation as economists talk about an ongoing persistent fall in the general price level.
It's a question from up the top.
If you want more information, I have a very good speech on that which I gave before Christmas, available on the bank's website.
Hello. Your predecessor speculated that it would take, I think, a couple of centuries for the UK to have sustainable convergence with Euroland and for us to thus be able to make a decision as to whether it would be wise to join the Euro. Is that a view you share, or do you think a good decision might be made a little bit faster than that?
There was certainly a decision will be made faster than that. I mean, we know that the decision is based on the outcome of the five tests, and we know the result of the five tests. Australia won 4-1. The remark that you quoted that is attributed to Mervyn. I mean, he was making a point which has been interpreted by the press as being a Eurosceptic remark, but was not really meant as that. It was intended as an honest academic's response to the question about how can you judge whether countries have converged on a sustainable basis. And to judge that, you will need to have observed a lot of business cycles, allow for a lot of idiosyncratic shocks across countries and so forth. And that's why, in principle, you need a lot of data to make a fairly unequivocal statement. At the end of the day, the government will have to take a view on whether it thinks the costs outweigh the benefits or vice versa. I should say, as far as the bank is concerned, we don't have a particular view on this. We will try and ensure that whatever the government and the people of this country decide is implemented as effectively as possible. So if we join, we'll try and play a full part in the European system of central banks, in the euro system. And if we stay out, we'll try to ensure that the current arrangements with the Monetary Policy Committee continue to operate reasonably satisfactorily.
One last question from the middle at the back.
Hello. You illustrate the success of inflation targeting in the UK to avoid inflation. But under the current Japanese deflation situation, do you think inflation targeting makes sense to avoid deflation?
I think instituting an inflation target before you get into deflation makes a lot of sense. I think one of the potential virtues of the inflation targeting regime, and particularly if you've managed to achieve or stay reasonably close to the inflation target for some time, is that it helps to anchor the inflationary expectations of private agents. What that means is that you're less likely to slip into a deflationary trap in the first place. It's a moot point whether introducing an inflation target once you're already in deflation, as Japan is, will actually accomplish very much for you. If the aim is to try and do something to raise inflationary expectations in order to get the real interest rate down, and that is essentially the part of the problem in Japan, that the real interest rate is too high. It's not the only problem. There are also problems in the banking system. But at least tackling the first of those problems, the issue is, would the announcement of an inflation target have any credibility? And I think it's quite legitimate to question whether it would be particularly credible to introduce one at the moment. If there was a way of doing it such that you could influence the private sector's expectations, it would be worth doing. But there clearly is a legitimate question about that.
Well, in closing, let me just say again, everyone is invited to the reception next door to the left. Let me congratulate the department on the centenary. And please give Charlie again a big vote of thanks for coming here tonight. Thank you.